From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Much has changed in North Carolina politics over the past 19 years. The NC Spin television program has been there to document those changes. The founding host joins us to mark a recent milestone and to promote NC Spin's new broadcast home. A data breach in the State Department of Health and Human Services generated big headlines in 2017. You'll learn why some lawmakers are now calling for increased accountability. Driverless cars are on their way to North Carolina. The State Department of Transportation is preparing. The state traffic engineer outlines key questions DOT must address. And we'll hear a free market economist's concerns about President Trump's proposed tariffs on washing machines and solar panels. He'll explain why American consumers would end up being the big losers. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Questions surround a $57.8 million fund that's part of a deal that grants permission for the Atlantic Coast Pipeline to be built through eastern North Carolina. The payment from the four utilities that are building the pipeline was announced minutes after the Cooper administration authorized pipeline permits. Carolina Journal has been digging into this deal, this memorandum of understanding, and the fund. And Rick Henderson joins me now. Rick, of course, is editor-in-chief. Welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
All right. So the Cooper administration approves the pipeline. And there have been a lot of questions, particularly from some in the governor's own party on the left, that environmentalists said, hey, this probably isn't a really good idea. But they decided to go ahead.
That's correct. Yeah. They approved the pipeline. There was a big divide among Democrats about this because an awful lot of Democrats who were interested in economic development, especially in the less prosperous areas along the route of the pipeline proposal, were saying this is huge because this is going to deliver a lot of natural gas to these communities that don't have access to large volumes of it, and that might help with economic development. On the other hand, there were the environmentalists who were saying this is simply increasing extending the lifespan of fossil fuel usage, which is a bad thing, and so therefore we should reject this pipeline.
We got word that the administration had issued the permits, so the utilities were pleased about that. That means the pipeline will be built. But just a few minutes after that came more information, Rick. This was a memorandum of understanding that goes along with this deal, and it involves $57.8 million. Tell us about that.
It is a memorandum of understanding between the operators and the governor of North Carolina for the money to be paid into an escrow account in two installments. The escrow account will be run by a third party designated by the governor, and the governor will control the money. The stated intention of the fund is to go to handle potential environmental problems caused by the pipeline, along with two other uses which are completely unrelated to environmental impacts, and that would be economic development projects in the affected counties and also renewable energy projects in the affected counties. And it says that the way the payments will be handled is to be determined when an executive order will be issued by the governor later, who will say how the money's going to be spent.
Well, based on that, an executive order from Governor Cooper, where does the General Assembly fit into this whole equation?
Nowhere. And that's the problem that we discussed and have tried to determine, is how does the governor negotiate an agreement for between a party like this in the state of North Carolina to deliver a sum of money to build this infrastructure and not involve the General Assembly at all, because the state constitution says very clearly that money that comes from settlements, and that includes things like fines and things like that, have to go through the state treasury. That there are situations such as the global settlement that led to the creation of Golden Leaf that
tobacco money
that went through a separate fund. However, that fund was not only authorized by the General Assembly, which signed off on the settlement, and also the General Assembly has appointments to the board that handles applications for grants from Golden Leaf. In this case, the governor not only set up the fund, he will control the fund, and he will decide how the money is spent. The General Assembly has no role in this whatsoever.
This sounds like really new territory for something like this. Is it unprecedented? You described a bit of things, but that was quite different.
This is unprecedented. The only thing that comes close to this, from what we can recall, is actually the settlement deal that was worked out between Smithfield Foods, the huge pork producer, and the Attorney General's office when Mike Easley was Attorney General. And that was a deal to pay $2 million a year for 15 years to the Attorney General to spend as the Attorney General saw fit on projects related to potential impacts of hog waste. Now, the money was spent for all sorts of things other than that. But again, it was a discretionary fund going through the Attorney General, and the Civitas Institute actually sued to argue that this violated the state constitution because it did not involve the General Assembly. It was a discretionary fund, a slush fund, as it was called at that time. And also that there is sort of a separation of powers question here, is that the governor does not get to appropriate, or the Attorney General does not get to appropriate money as he sees fit. Only the General Assembly gets to. So there's that sort of analogy. Now, in that particular case, Civitas lost at trial court, and the Court of Appeals now has that case.
If the General Assembly is going to play no role in this discretionary fund, again, we're talking about $57.8 million and that Governor Cooper controlling what it's spent on, what's been the reaction from the leadership of the General Assembly?
Well, the initial reaction from Senator Phil Berger, who heads the Senate, was issued before we heard about the fund, and he was praising the fact that the governor finally has come along and let the pipeline happen. He thought it was a great thing. And then all of a sudden we hear this about
but wait, there's more.
All of a sudden we hear about this deal, and there's dead silence. And what we're hearing from the General Assembly leadership is that this is such a legal oddity that they don't know what to make of it. They're suspicious of it. They're not going to say right now that it's unconstitutional or that it's not allowed, but they just can't figure out exactly how it jives with state law and with the state constitution.
Now, this pipeline goes through several states, including Virginia. Now, there's a deal that the state of Virginia has signed, and you've been comparing the Virginia deal and the North Carolina deal. And so in Virginia, if I understand correctly, Rick, there is a fund for mitigation.
Right.
But in the North Carolina deal, this $58 million discretionary fund, there's also an area that says it could be spent on something called economic development.
Right.
What does that have to do with mitigation of any effects of a pipeline?
Nothing. And just to explain about the mitigation part of it, typically if someone's going to build a project that may have some environmental disruptions, there are a couple of ways you can deal with this. You will either have the company say, we're going to put forward a certain amount of money that will be available in a bond that will be able to be used to pay the damaged parties. Or you may have a situation in which you would have a payment go again into another fund that the General Assembly might control, for instance. Or you would have money go to directly to groups or to agencies that handle these sorts of things. In the Virginia case, that's what happened. There was a certain proportion of the money, believe it or not, $57.85 million.
Oh.
Very, very close to the amount,
right.
Was going to handle about $24 million was going to handle migratory wildlife, I believe. A certain amount, about $20 million, was going to handle water quality, and the remainder was going to go for restoration of land that was disrupted, forest land that was disrupted by this. So, I mean, there it was spelled out. X amount of money is going to go here, X amount of money is going to go there, and the money was all taken up. And the agreement was negotiated by the state's environmental regulators on behalf of the Commonwealth of Virginia. In this case, the deal appears to have been negotiated entirely by the governor's staff
in North Carolina
on behalf of the state of North Carolina, but still, Governor Cooper controls the fund, not the different regulatory agencies, which normally would do that.
Lastly, Rick, I know that you have requested some documents, and as of the time you and I are talking, you haven't received them.
That's right. We've made multiple requests. The Department of Environmental Quality has said they're going to comply with the records request that we've given to them. We've gotten nothing from the governor at all, no response whatsoever.
Lots more reporting to come, no doubt, from Carolina Journal. You can read the stories at carolinajournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. A lot more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Much has changed in North Carolina politics over the past 1,000 weeks. That's more than 19 years, if you're doing a little bit of arithmetic there. Our next guest has been keeping track of all of these changes and helping television viewers across North Carolina keep track of them, too. Tom Campbell is the host and moderator of NC Spin, that weekly television program recently marked its 1,000th episode. First of all, congratulations.
Makes me feel old.
Congratulations on
that. Thank you.
Thank you. Accomplishment.
That's a lot of TV.
That is a lot of TV, and you have obviously, during the course of that time, seen a lot of changes in North Carolina politics.
So many that it's almost hard to put your finger on all of them. I think the biggest changes I've seen, first of all, the change from the shift of power in North Carolina. It used to be that most of the political power was east of I-95. No longer the case. All of the east now is solidly red Republican. The more urban areas are now more Democratic, so far as elections are concerned. The legislature itself has changed quite a bit since my dad served there back in the 70s. It is more highly partisan, less collegial than it used to be. I can remember even when I was Harlan Bull's chief deputy that it was not uncommon at all to have these big receptions that Glaxo and Sass and all of these people would put on. And you'd see the Republican and Democrat legislators, and they'd have arms around each other's shoulders, and they were telling stories to each other. And a fair amount of legislation actually got done during those times as they were able to get to know each other and cross the aisles to get work done. Not so today. The other thing is that whereas we like to talk about the fact that the power resides in the Senate President pro tem and the House Speaker, the reality is today it really resides with the caucuses. And in both instances, Republican and Democratic, those caucuses are pretty well split. In fact, they're bigger fractions there than people know. And one of the things that Tom Tillis used to tell me when he was House Speaker is, I can only get done what my caucus will allow to work. And sometimes the old mainstream Republicans, for instance, I'm talking about the Jim Holzhauser, the Jim Martin, the Jim Broyhill, a faction of the Republican Party.
All the ones named Jim.
Yeah, they're still there, but they're a lot quieter and more silent. And the more fundamental to the right Republicans have taken over. In like manner, the same thing has happened with the Democratic Party. You don't hear much from the mainstream Democrats that we used to know through the years. So a lot of political changes. But I think the biggest change has probably taken place in the media. When you go back and look at it 19 years ago, yes, there was an internet. Yes, there were flip-top cell phones, if you remember, but the smartphone hadn't been existed. It hadn't been invented. The internet itself was not as much of an entity. People weren't into the blogging and the Facebook and the Google and the social media and all of the other things that were taking place. Newspapers were still the top of the king of the hill, so to speak. Television stations were rising, emerging, local TV, and cable television, the networks, cable television networks were just beginning their ascent and influence on politics. All of these things have had just a tremendous impact. And frankly, it makes us believe that with this has been a large splintering or fractioning, if you will, of the audiences. And because of that fact, we think that what we're doing is perhaps maybe even more important today than it was in 1998 when we first got started, because there are not many places where you can go and get kind of a balanced debate for the old North State, as we like to say.
That is the voice of Tom Campbell. He is host and moderator of NC Spin. We're going to have some very interesting information to those of you who are listening and saying, you know, I haven't seen it on the air lately. There's a reason, if you're watching at the old location, why you aren't seeing NC Spin, and we'll tell you where you could see it coming up. But you referenced this, the change in the collegiality and the change in the way that that both sides of a political argument will operate and respond to each other. That's one thing that really hasn't changed on NC Spin. You get people of very different views, but they'll sit down and talk to each other and not just shout at each other.
From the outset, one of the guidelines, and by the way, your listeners might be interested in knowing how this all got started. I was at an event one night and ran into John Hood and told him I'd been a big fan of John McLaughlin and the McLaughlin Group on PBS. I was the licensee for Fox 50, the television station here in Raleigh-Durham, and I was intrigued by McLaughlin's show. McLaughlin himself was a bit brusque, and I didn't like him as a moderator all that much, but I liked the idea of having a show where you could hear different sides of issues. And I mentioned that to John. And he said, funny you should mention that, because he said, I used to work as a researcher for Fred Barnes on that show. I know how the show's built. I know how it's formatted. If you're really serious about wanting to start a show like that in North Carolina, I can tell you how to do it. And by the way, I'd like to be on it. And I said, well, okay, you'll represent one end of the spectrum. We got to get someone to represent the other end. And both of us just almost simultaneously said, Chris Fitzsimon. We met at TK Tripp's restaurant, sat down over a napkin over lunch one day, and that's how the show got started.
And both Chris Fitzsimon and John Hood continue to serve as your standard left-right anchors on that show today.
And have through most of the thousand shows. And an awful lot of the viewers tell me that they tune in to watch John and Chris, hoping that they'll get into it with each other. But back to your original point, we said from the outset, we're Southern ladies and gentlemen. I will not moderate. I will not produce a show in which everybody's yelling at each other, calling each other names, speaking over top of each other. The viewer gets no benefit from that whatsoever, and I'm just not going to be part of that. I don't want it.
Well, it's a very interesting element that we don't see in much of the rest of politics today, a civil debate on issues.
As now, Chris says, we can disagree without being disagreeable.
Exactly. Now, if people are listening to us and saying, yeah, NC Spin, one of the main ways that I get news about politics and policy, but I haven't seen it lately. Where did it go? Tell us what is currently happening with NC Spin.
Well, our last show on commercial TV stations across the state was December 31st. Mitch, we're delighted that we are now part of the UNC TV network and that we will be airing Friday nights at 7:30 p.m. and again on Sunday afternoons at 12:30. And you can see us on the North Carolina channel, UNC TV. Friday nights at 10 p.m., Saturdays at 4 p.m., and again on Sundays at 10 a.m.
Tom Campbell is the host and moderator of NC Spin, now available to be seen once again each week for maybe 1,000 more episodes.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute, Mitch. I'm not in for that. I've told them I'm going to try to do until through the elections of 2020 up until the end of the year 2020.
Okay, that is Tom Campbell making a promise that we'll see at least a couple more years of NC Spin now on UNC-TV. Thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A data breach in the State Department of Health and Human Services generated headlines in 2017. Secretary Mandy Cohen recently briefed lawmakers on steps her department is taking to avoid a repeat performance.
Our technology folks, contracting folks, policy folks, operational folks are all in and sitting around the same table as we're discussing it right now. So it's not that we're writing the policy, then we hand it over to the IT and they build it, and then they come back to it and we think about our business process, and then we think, oh, how should we communicate about this? It's really all up front, and I spend the time to talk about that because I think it's a really important philosophy and a change in the way that we're doing our business.
Republican Representative Nelson Dollar pushed back.
In all the talk you just gave, is there going to be disciplinary action, either in this specific case or in cases going forward? Because, I mean, all the things you said are all good, and I think most everybody in the room would agree with them, but if it doesn't come with, you know, some kind of disciplinary action on occasions when people are not, you know, following through on all the, I don't want to say happy talk, because I realize it's what you said is more serious than that, but But is there going to be real accountability in the system for things that are not met, breaches that are made, and the like? Because we've seen in the past in this department, it wasn't under your tutelage, but under others, where no disciplinary action was taken, hundreds of millions of dollars were wasted, all kinds of things went on because there was really no accountability for maybe a variety of reasons. But so, you know, we want to be, I think the General Assembly wants to be able to see that.
I appreciate that, and it's something I think about every day in the job that I am doing. And I think when I am thinking about how we build our system, I want to take as much of the uncertainty of human action out of this, right? Why does our system let you do, right? Why isn't there a technology solution that will prevent some risky thing happening on the data security side, right? Why is that even, why are we even there is my point. So how do we build systems? Great. I don't think these are bad people. I think it is systems that we are focused on, and how do we create our systems to make sure that folks are able to use them and do the job that they want to do. So, right, if it requires a human to think, you know, to do something every single time perfectly, that's just not a sustainable way. So how do we create a system that has a check on that?
You've been listening to discussion of a recent data breach at the State Department of Health and Human Services. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day: jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. With driverless cars on their way toward North Carolina roadways, how is the state preparing? Kevin Lacey is state traffic engineer with the North Carolina Department of Transportation. He recently offered state lawmakers a status report.
I look at this, and there's a lot of certainties and uncertainties. And when we start talking about from a Department of Transportation perspective, when we start doing things different, we think about risk. If we go out and say, well, you know what, the autonomous vehicle is going to reduce VMTs by 20%, and we're wrong. And we build for a minus 20%, the world is going to be hurting. And if we say, well, you know, autonomous vehicles is going to increase VMTs by 20%, and we build for that, then we got a lot of wasted infrastructure we built. But there are some certainties. The car will change. It's going to grow smarter. The passenger, we originally had the driver. There will not be a driver. Everyone will be a passenger. Roadways, you know, until Uber Air and other air gets into play, the roads and bridges are still going to be needed, still need to be maintained. And then the role of DMVs and DOTs, it will change. What we don't know is how and when.
Lacey identifies other uncertainties about driverless cars, also known as autonomous vehicles.
The rate of acceptance. When are people ready to get in these vehicles when no one is driving? Some people say never. Some people are ready to do it yesterday. Infrastructure requirements. We've heard connected vehicles. You know, it costs us billions of dollars a year for the asphalt and concrete. When we start putting high-tech stuff on the side of the road that changes every 6 months.
That's the voice of Kevin Lacey. He's state traffic engineer with the North Carolina Department of Transportation. He's discussing the many questions surrounding driverless cars on North Carolina roadways. Another key question involves network management.
There's going to be folks out there managing, whether it's fleet management or so forth. Transportation funding model, that's the question that we look for you guys. How are we going to solve this? And then, of course, vehicle ownership. Is that going to change? We've heard yes, no, maybe, possibly. Well, today, the current ownership is we generally predominantly own one or more vehicles. We park at our house, and we drive to work or wherever we're going. And there's a possibility that single ownership will continue in the future. I mean, Tesla's looking at a $35,000 price point. We all love that instant gratification of driving, walking out to the car, getting in the car, and driving somewhere. We like that. Are we willing to give that up? Some areas, we may. What about group ownership, where you have a group of people owning multiple vehicles from that standpoint? How do we collect the taxes and so forth from that? Who's responsible? Who owns it? Who's going to keep it upkeep? And then, you know, the corporate ownership, GM was talking about owning a fleet of vehicles. Uber owns a fleet of vehicles. Is that going to be the predominant way? My belief is it's going to be all of the above. There will always be somebody owning their own vehicle because that's what they want to do. But it's, you know, when we start looking at which of these other models are going to be predominant in the transportation industry, it's going to come down to the individuals making what's best for them. And is that choice available?
Driverless cars present plenty of questions for the state DOT itself.
How about the typical model that you see in North Carolina is that we have a lot of folks living in the suburban areas driving into call centers or job centers. That might be another a trip scenario. How many people have given up their single ridership vehicle for the shared ride called transit? We've invested a lot of money in transit across the country. We still have a relatively low ridership in transit. Design. What is this going to do for design? Whether it's how we communicate to the drivers with a sign or the machine, because we will have a period of time where we will still drive and there will be some autonomous vehicles on the roadway. But when we start looking at in that future date when there is an opportunity where there is predominantly autonomous vehicles out there, they can drive closer together, both linearly and laterally. They can drive at higher speeds closer together, and you can get a lot more capacity out of the existing roadway. That's a good thing. When do we start doing that? Back to that risk. Personally, we are not ready to start doing that yet, but we need to start planning on how do we deal with that.
What about highway construction?
How do you deal with a construction zone? You know, until we go the third dimension, we will be dealing with construction zones. And do we just avoid them altogether? What about how do we operate the system as a whole? Right now, we do have a bunch of individual people who operate their vehicles. They know what system and what roads that they typically drive on. You know the route that you take to work every day and go home every day. Sometimes you wonder, how did you get home? Because I don't remember passing such, because we drive in an autonomous way already. But how about controlling these fleets? You know, from an aviation standpoint, we have traffic controllers. Are we looking at that? Well, in urban areas, we have traffic operation centers that try to help guide motorists around events, you know, such as wrecks and other things of that nature.
Lacey says the changes also will impact DOT's bottom line.
There's not a single portion of this that really isn't touched. Just about the entire dollar is touched in some way or another. Motor fuel tax. You know, if gasoline and diesel are no longer the predominant mode of moving vehicles around, then that's where that's come from. Highway use tax, how do you collect that? Back to if it's shared ownership, is that going to reduce the number of vehicles? If it's fleet ownership, Is that going to reduce the number of vehicles out there? Likely. But you'll get a better utilization of those. As we've heard, between 90 and 95%, your car's parked all the time. Fees. Some of those fees are driver license fees. You know, if you don't need a driver license to operate or ride in an autonomous vehicle, then you won't be collecting that. Titles and so forth, you've seen those as well. So when we start talking about revenues, I mean, I call the gas tax is kind of a trickle charge. You don't get one great big bill at the beginning of the year or at the end of the year and say, well, Kevin, you bought 500 gallons of gas this year. Here's your bill for gasoline tax. We pay a little bit of it at a time, and we get used to paying that trickle charge. Is that going to be from the electric vehicle standpoint? How do you share that across state lines? What about from a federal perspective? When we look at the predominant transportation system, it is asphalt and concrete. That stuff moves very slow. It does not change very rapidly. You throw technology into the world, it changes every other day. At least every 6 months, you're looking at newer, better, faster, quicker, all that stuff coming out there. Is that something that a Department of Transportation, are we going to be able to afford to maintain and keep that technology up? Or do we let a third party handle that?
That's Kevin Lacey, state traffic engineer with the North Carolina Department of Transportation. He's discussing the many questions surrounding driverless cars in North Carolina's future. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Full color throughout every issue. More visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read. A new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. President Trump has announced that he intends to place heavy tariffs on two brands of imported washing machines, LG and Samsung, and on imported solar panels and other solar power-related hardware. Well, that is bad news for U.S. consumers, says our next guest. Dr. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. He's writing that this tariff policy is in direct conflict with the president's stated goal of putting America first. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back, Donna.
First of all, explain for us, what is a tariff?
Well, tariff is nothing but a tax. So it's just like if you were going to tax cigarettes or alcohol or anything like that. It's what we call an excise tax, but it's a tax on the purchase of a particular product. In this case, washing machines. I believe they're made in Korea by LG and
Samsung.
Samsung, thank you. So it's a specific tax on those products and on solar panels.
How would that then make the product more expensive? I mean, does it simply just raise the price by
just
a certain amount?
Just like any tax does, right?
You
put a tax on cigarettes. You got more expensive cigarettes. A tax on gasoline, you got more expensive gasoline. So it's the same way. But it also raises the prices in other ways because it restricts competition for all washing machines, right? Which just raises price of washing machines and solar panels, for that matter, across the board, because you're just going to have less supply of the good in the United States, which means higher prices.
The president, though, says that this is about fairness and about mm-hmm. protecting Americans. What do you make of his argument?
Well, it certainly doesn't protect American consumers, right? They have to pay the tax. So you know, it does protect some Americans, right? Those producing those particular products. But it hurts the vast majority of Americans, all the consumers, not only of those products, but of related products. To say it helps Americans, it is certainly not the case.
So if I go to buy a washing machine after this tariff is imposed, mm-hmm. essentially that means then that those particular brands that have the tariff applied, they're going to be more expensive than other brands that might actually be the same type of washing machine or the same quality.
It'll be more expensive than those other brands, but all those other brands will be more expensive. So relatively speaking, they'll be more expensive, but the whole general price of washing machines will be higher for Americans. And let me say, as I say in that story, less expensive for foreign consumers.
How's
of washing
that?
Machines.
How's that work?
Well, these companies, LG, Samsung, they will try to sell now more of their product overseas from the United States in other countries besides the United States to make up for that. Well, what does that mean? It means the supply of those washing machines in those other countries will be greater, be lower in the United States, but greater in those other countries, which means lower prices. So really what we're doing with that tariff is subsidizing the price of washing machines for what, the French, the Italians, the Canadians, whoever. So I do not see how that's putting America first.
It is interesting that
putting bad economics first, by the way.
It's interesting that the president and the Congress passed federal tax cuts and tax reform
right.
just a few weeks ago. So you have on the one hand tax cuts, which are designed to make sure that people keep more of the money that they earn.
Right.
But now you have this tariff looming, which would make products more expensive. So sounds to me like those are competing forces on the pocketbook.
And they absolutely are. And, you know, if the president just took the same economics that he used to put through his tax plan and to support his tax plan and thought about it and extended it to trade, he'd realize just how bad protectionist policies like this are. The fact is that they don't do any good except to protect particularly favored industries. And that's what tariffs are always about. It's really a form of crony capitalism.
What would you say to people, though, who say, look, you know, the president is right. He's looking out for us, and this is putting America first.
Well, he's not looking out for me. I don't produce any washing machines. I consume washing machines. I buy washing machines. So I'm an American. That's not putting me first. So I don't understand the language. It's putting some Americans first, those he thinks should be benefited and get a wealth transfer from American consumers. Look, who is he protecting? He's protecting these American companies from the decisions of American consumers not to buy their product. The whole problem is that American consumers are deciding freely to buy LGs, right? Washing machines. And that's who the American producer is being protected from, the decisions of American consumers. Now we're going to penalize American consumers for making those decisions. It's wrong.
So it sounds as if the idea of the tariff is that we're going to pick particular companies or industries to, quote, protect. It sounds very similar to the rhetoric that we hear in the state of North Carolina, mm-hmm. for example, when we talk about, well, trying to get Amazon to build its second headquarters.
It is a form of corporate welfare. Absolutely. It's just using a different tool to convey benefits on certain companies over American consumers.
Roy, in the president's State of the Union address, he talked a bit about trade briefly, and he referred to the issue of trade saying essentially that he wants, as he describes it, fair trade and reciprocal trade. What does that mean?
You know what? That's a great question. To me, all trade is reciprocal, right? I can't imagine free trade, any kind of exchange, not being reciprocal. I give you something you want, you give me something I want. That's reciprocal. And that's the definition of all trade. So it's really kind of a silly way of looking at it. To be quite frank, I just think it shows ignorance of the nature of trade on the part of the president. And what could be more fair than something that's mutually beneficial and voluntary on both parts? So the rhetoric I don't understand. A lot of people use this kind of rhetoric, but I think it's, from an economics perspective, really nonsensical.
It's really popular rhetoric.
Absolutely.
Right now. You have a lot
Absolutely.
Of people who embrace this type of thinking. So what do folks like yourself who are free traders, what do you say to try to explain to people that while the president's words sound comforting, you know, we're going to be protected, et cetera, that in the long run, these really aren't positive things to do?
Well, first of all, I would challenge them to say, show me any situation where – or any time in our history where protectionism has actually benefited the American economy, where it has helped the economy grow. Certainly the Smoot-Hawley tariffs in the 1930s made the recession, the Great Depression, much worse than it otherwise would have been. There's no empirical evidence to suggest, besides there's no economic argument to suggest that protectionism benefits an economy as a whole. It benefits some at the expense of others.
It's a really interesting piece that you've written, Roy, a very timely piece as the president is talking more and more about trade and issues of the economy and using some protectionist rhetoric that a lot of people are responding to. Dr. Roy Cordato is senior economist for the John Locke Foundation. Roy, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And that's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org. Or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.